And welcome to a very special edition of the Talking Talkie podcast. This morning I'm joined by Ben Curry.
Hello.
Nick French.
Hello.
And one of, in my opinion, the greatest managers to manage our football club, Mr. Martin Ling. Martin, how are you?
Yeah, I'm all good, thanks. Looking forward to the interview.
Thank you. Yeah, we're delighted to have you on. Well, let's get straight into it. So, talk here off the back of a playoff final defeat. Paul Buckles left to join Bristol Rovers with several key members of the first team squad. Did you apply for the job? Were you approached classic Torquay fashion? How did the move come about?
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard the job was available. If I remember rightly, sent the CV down. But didn't hear nothing originally, and then I was contacted to say would I like to come down for an interview. I went down for that interview, and while I was driving home, within an hour, maybe 45 minutes of driving home, they'd offered me the job, if I'm honest. So I turned the car back round and got it done, because it was getting very close to pre-season. And there wasn't a lot of time to get ready. So the quicker I could get in once the personal terms had been agreed, it was essential that I got in there as quick as I possibly could.
And when you came down and you met the team, were you aware of any of the players? Was there anyone that really stood out to you and anyone that surprised you when you first met the squad?
No, I mean, I wasn't that aware of what was in the dressing room. I'd know there was... departures and obviously coming off the back of that, that playoff defeat, there was negativity about, I think, when I first come down, and when I was talking to the board, they were talking more about being away from the bottom two than they were being in the top seven, if I'm totally honest at that time. Once I got in there and started to look around, I realised there were some really good players within the building. People like Eunan O'Kane, Lee Mansell, Kevin Nixon, to name but three. But yeah, there was players there that you felt, wow, there's more than a struggling League Two within the building. And to add a few players to that, and it's always nice when you've got a core of decent players. You still had Robinson, Ellis. There was a good team down there. They needed a few more players to be brought in to make it a squad. But the nucleus was good.
Was moving to Torquay or near to Torquay a bit of a culture shock? Because obviously in the southwest, it's a bit out on the limb. Our training facilities and our stadium were going through a bit of a revamp. So did you find that difficult or travel difficult in any way, considering that you were a bit more used to being at Orient and Cambridge and a bit closer to home?
Yeah, I mean, there was difficulty, and there was obviously I started my career at Exeter, so that I knew the area. I had relations within the area in terms of Caroline's, my wife's brother lived in Exeter, so I moved in with him. So there was familiarity in there. My in-laws lived in Exeter. But yeah, it was a long way from home. It was the first time that I'd left my family. My boys, I think they were 14 and 15, my boy and girl at the stage. So important time at school. And also important time for in a football sense for Sam, who was like a player at Leighton Orient at that time. So there was no way the family were moving. But there was familiarity in terms of the area. But yeah, it was a long way from home, but I felt comfortable because I'd been down there before. I think less comfortable if I'd never known the West Country. I knew it quite well because obviously when I was at Exeter, I met my wife Caroline, who was from Exeter, so I knew the South West well enough to be comfortable with the surroundings.
Did you find that knowing the Southwest was key in trying to attract players down? Because we hear quite a lot of supporters how difficult it is to get players to commit to coming down to the southwest and to buying into a project down here, because the nature of football is short term. What did you use in terms of sort of tactics to try and get players to come down?
Yeah, I mean, it's out on a limb, and we all know that it's out on a limb. But I think the attraction I tried to build into is how nice the area actually is. You know, once you come to the area, you get a lot of people that then settle in the area. So it's an actual place to live. I think it's a lovely place to live, you know, in terms of that. And that's what I tried to do quite a bit of my selling on, is that, you know, it's an area which you'll enjoy your time there, whether it's with your family or on your own. And the same as you know, that would be a plus for people. You know, the negativity is if you start talking about we're going to be on the coach for 3 hours before we get anywhere on a Friday, that's the difficult with it sometimes, is the distance that you have to travel for the away games. I think, if I'm right to say, it was 21 out of 23 away games were overnight, and that's what you had to cope with. But once you get people into the area and charm, I think there's a lot of people that love it. You know, including myself, I've always thought I'd end up back in the West Country, if I'm honest with you. Me and my wife talked about it when the football career was over, but I suppose now I'm 56 now, so the fact that we might move down there, it might be just to be, you know, to pick our pension up from the local post office between us, by the looks of it.
So you get into pre-season, and like you say, there's a good nucleus of the squad. You brought in some really key members of the first team playing squad in Alejnik, Saar, and Rene Howe. Who were they players that, obviously, you knew of Brian Saar from previous, but were you aware of Bobby Alejnik? Were you aware of Rene? And with Rene, did you see him as a bit of a project at the start?
Yeah, I mean, I always feel that I can work people that have got some sort of character that people are not quite sure of, and I think Rennie would come into that bracket. I always believe that everybody's got an on-off switch. Some people have it hidden deeper than others, but Rennie was a pleasure for me, and all I could hear was bad stories. But I just see a player that could help us get up the pitch, that someone who was a good finisher. I didn't know nothing about Bobby. You know, he come to me. I watched some clips, looked at him, and I thought, well, he's decent, you know what I mean? And was surprised that we got him. Obviously, I knew everything about Brian Saar because he'd been with me at both Leighton Orient and Cambridge. You know, he actually works for me again now, to be honest with you. I mean, so he was someone I was comfortable with. Yeah, but Bobby and Rennie are, you know, two massive components of our success. It was a case of when you're managing Torquay, Leighton Orient, or Cambridge, you're going to find players that have got issues, and I never ever shied away from that. I always felt that if you treat people right and treat them properly, then you'll always get the best out of them. I didn't look at the negatives in people. That wasn't the way I did things.
With Brian Saar, he was your captain at Leighton Orient and Cambridge. Was the assumption that he'd end up being captain with you at Torquay? And what were your first couple of meetings with Lee Mansell, who was obviously our captain at the time? Was there any awkwardness there?
Yeah, look, Brian's someone I trust and someone that I've made captain at previous clubs. But when I met Lee, from the first minute I met Lee, I had a very, very great relationship with him early from really early. And I made my mind up that I wasn't going to change that. I just felt he was the perfect leader. He was one that you'd always guarantee that would give you everything in every single game, and he was one that people wanted to go with, and so there was no. But in my head, when I first time signed Brian, there was that thinking that if there isn't a natural leader down here, then Brian could have done that. But once I met Lee, see Lee around the training ground, there was no need for me to change anything.
So we get into the season, and obviously for the fans, one of the fixtures there were plenty of fixtures we were really looking out for that year. One of them was obviously the Bristol Rovers one, with Buckle having gone there. Were you aware of, kind of, for the fans, the magnitude of that? And even on the day, were you aware that the BBC were doing a feature on Paul Buckle and kind of billing it to be his big sort of, well, home debut for his new club?
Yeah, look, obviously I knew of what had happened and how Paul had left. So I knew there was some bad blood, you know, in terms of how things went. But for me, it's about working on that and getting that to our advantage. You know, things like saying to the players, you know, he left you because he didn't think he was good enough. You know, he didn't think you could go where he wants to go. So now you've got to show him that he was wrong. So it was about getting the players' mindset right against him. I had nothing against Paul Buckle. I didn't know him at all. Well, I knew him to say hello to, but there was no, and I see from my side of it, but it was to get into the players' mindset that really he thought we were too small as a club. You wasn't good enough as players. And once you start doing that, you do get a bit of a herd mentality that sets in, and that's what happened.
Do you feel that the win at the Memorial on that day was one that really sort of set you up with the supporters? Because from a supporter perspective, sometimes it can take a little bit of time to warm to a manager. I mean, I'll be honest, through Paul's time at Torquay, I was never really warm to him, even though he had incredible success with us. I never found him to be a warm character. We've had some great conversations since he's left, and he's done an interview with us as well. And, you know, that feeling is completely gone now. But you kind of ingrained yourself into Torquay folklore by the performance and the passion and the win on that day.
Yeah, look, you know, that was an easy win for me. It's, you know, the game, the result wasn't easy, but I mean, it was an easy win. If I was successful there, then people would, it would be easier to like me. You know, that's obvious. I think wherever I've been, you know, I've never had any trouble with any fans that I've ever worked with, really. Because I think that I'm open and I'm honest. Sometimes people would say I was too honest for my own good in terms of how I spoke, how media-wise. But I just felt I always believe that you don't treat supporters as idiots. Treat them as humans that are pulling in the same direction to you. And if you're honest and open, you know, people, that doesn't mean you can go and lose loads of games of football and they want you out. But it gives you, what you're trying to do is build up time for when things are not going so well. And that's, and I think if you are that open, honest person and people see that about you, they walk away and say, well, you know, yeah, this ain't quite right, but at least he tells us honestly and openly what's going on in he said and what's going on at the club. And I think that's important. I don't believe all these taglines, what you should say, you know, go out into interview. I've never gone into an interview ever in my life with a tagline in my head that I'm going to say because it get people on side. I just speak from the heart and people either take to me or don't take to me. And so I've never had any problem being a football manager for people taking to me.
I can vouch for that. I met you very early on in that season at Dagenham away game, and you shook my hand. You gave me 5 minutes before kickoff, and it meant the world to me. You know, I'd never known a manager at the club to do that for me, so I knew that the club was in very safe hands just by you giving me the time of day, which some managers just don't. Just lastly on that Rovers game, it's one of our favourite moments. We always talk about it. Is Mark Clement dangling a microphone in Paul Buckle's face after the game and him sort of panicking. In the cold light of day, did you and the lads have a slight chuckle about that on the way home and after the match? We always find it quite funny.
Yeah, look, I mean, the thing is with it is that you've won the day, you've got the upper hand, you smile about it and everybody, yeah. To see someone that's left you suffering anyway is good, and not, you know, ain't nasty. It's just a good way to get even for a situation that you've been left in. Because I say a lot of the players, you know, there was talk about everybody going and he was going to take this player and take that player, and you know it was going to be him go, and then he was going to come and take a lot of squad. And as I say, once it didn't happen, I think I could use that. And yeah, there's always laughter of people suffering, as long as it ain't you suffering.
There were so many key players that season in a first team that you didn't make too many changes to. I think one of the standout names from that season, and to be honest, is still spoken about now as one of the best players to put on a shirt. Well, the shirt is Ewan O'Kane. How good was he?
It's amazing, isn't it, when you walk into a place and when I looked at Ewan and I thought, wow, where's this? You know, what's happened here? Where is the, you know, why is he playing at Torquay? Was my honest answer. I see a lot of similarities to my own game, if I'm honest. You know, I was a very, if I could pick one player that was similar to me as a player, it was Ewan. And probably Ewan had been told all his career, like part of his career, about what he couldn't do defensively. And you know, I was the same. I was a good player when managers looked at what I could do on the ball. And people talk about people being brave, you know, being honest and brave on the pitch. And that's, a lot of people will look at that as someone who's going to tackle with his face or going for a slide tackle. I look at that differently because the type of player I was that I would take the ball in any given situation and never shy away from doing that. And Ewan was the same. But you do need, you know, I've had managers, not many, but I've had managers that you know, I didn't see eye to eye with because I wasn't so good at the defensive side. And then I see managers that you know, worried about what I, you know, that, you know, someone like David Webb at Southend, for instance, would just say, "I don't care what you do defensively. I want you to get on the ball and hurt people." You know, just to name drop another one, Glenn Oddle was absolutely superb for me because he won't sell me. I defended too much, and because I kept coming back over the halfway line, and I was like, "What's that all about?" You know, I've been told all my life that you need to improve your defending. And I was the same with Ewan. All I was right about Ewan doing as defensively was just getting the way, because he ain't going to go and do the tackles and whatever you want. But when he's on the ball, go and express yourself. And he was the best player we had. He was the jewel in the crown, if it was honest. And it didn't surprise me. He went on to bet bigger and better things. Just a shame. I still speak to him every now and then and his agent every now and then. Just a shame what happened to him injury-wise, because I think he would have been top in there. I think sometimes when you're a Ewan type and it, sometimes you're going to be better. I always say people like who are Ewan type players are going to be better when they're 23 than when they are 16. You just got to let them develop into their body because they're not going to be the biggest and strongest early on. But eventually they learn. And he was first class for me.
We struggled a little bit in that first season at the beginning. I think we went 8 games without a win. But you were very emphatic in saying that the answers were in the building, and you were going to find them. And, you know, you see managers these days, their first instinct is going to transfer market. Whereas you put Damon Lathrop into a 3-man midfield and changed formation and freed Ewan O'Kane a bit more forward. And from that moment on, I think we beat Wimbledon 4-0 on a Tuesday night. We never looked back. How much satisfaction does it give you when you can see a change and you make it and it pays off so handsomely as that?
Yeah, again, it's something that I've carried throughout my coaching career, is that I think that people see bad in people first before they see good. And I could see that there was a lot of good within the dressing room. It may need a bit of tinkering, but I didn't think I always think the answers, a lot of managers always think the answers outside. And I think they go to that default position first. You know, we've got to change this, we've got to get this, we've got to get that, and you come into it and it's no better. You know, you can only judge it with your own eyes. I could see the character, I could see the ability. You know, it just felt for me that we needed a flick of a switch and things could change. And because I come in so late in the pre-season, I've always felt it was going to take a bit of time to get us going. And once we did, as you say, it was excellent. And you don't all get it right. Sometimes it can be a signing from outside, but I believe that, you know, a lot of your answers will come from within the building. And if you show belief in people, they tend to repay you more times than they don't.
Damon Lathrop must have been an absolute manager's dream.
Yeah, look, Dane was one of the ones who, you know, never complained, done the job. You know, you ain't going to never get the star man in games, but for a manager, you know, people like him and Lee Mansell, you know, Kevin Nicholson, you know, they were But Damon was a dream, because what he allowed to do, he allowed other people to go and play, and he would do his job, and come out of it with plaudits. And they say he would be a lot more appreciated by management and coaches than he would be from supporters, I feel.
How easy is it to be able to say to someone like Unan, or obviously you brought Billy Bowden in, you know, on loan, how easy is it to say to those players, these are the guys that are going to do the legwork for you. You go out and just make something happen.
Yeah, I think that's important. Again, it's a team, and it needs to be built as a team, and you need people that are prepared to do the harder graft. But people, as long as you've got them people understand that when you get it, you're going to express yourself. It's no good having a Union and a Billy Bowden type player and they don't produce. You know, that's a pressure in itself, but you knew that there was quality in the pair of them. But yeah, it's a team, as you say. The way I look at it, I always think you're probably looking for probably three players like Bowden, O'Kane, and even Rennie Howe to a certain degree that are more, more of the thrill type players, and you're going to need maybe seven or eight. If you've got it the other way round, you ain't going to win nothing. You know what I mean? You're going to have eight the flair players and three that are grafters. You've got to have, especially in the lower two leagues, you've got to have that balance. Sometimes you go 7 and 4, but you've got to be careful you don't go too many of the flair type, because someone's got to get them the ball. And I think we had a good mix.
There was a famous double that season. Obviously, we hadn't played Plymouth Argyle in the league for some time, and certainly hadn't got a league double over them in a very long time. Talk to us about that home game, because as fans, it was almost the perfect game. I mean, all three of the goals were, you know, goal of the month contenders, but especially that one from Union. Talk to us about that and what it was like going into that.
They're the easiest games to manage, if I'm totally honest, because you don't have to inspire the players. You know, the atmosphere and the rivalry is already there. We all know what it means. So some of the time with that is about calming people. You know, because I think some players get overexcited, or you know, and don't perform because they build it up so much in their head. So a lot of that for me was about, you know, bringing it down, you know, the big boys from around the corner, again, working on that. You know, they think they're bigger, they think they're better, you know, than what we are. And building that mentality of being the underdog and coming out on top. But, you know, sometimes you look at it and, you know, tactically, and you set the team up and it all comes off. But, yeah, they're the easiest. They are the easier games to manage because, as I say, it's about fetching players down rather than building them up. Sometimes you know when you're playing games, it's about inspiring them to go and do things. In them games, you don't need to be inspired. The atmosphere is, you know, red hot, and the atmosphere for you as a player is good. So it's about calming the mind sometimes in them situations. So, I think less is more in them type of situations, because you can, as a manager, get engrossed in it. So you start rattling off more and more and more. So whenever the thing got bigger and bigger and bigger, I've always been one that says less and less and less, because I think that if I'm getting excited and my mind's racing, the players is the same. So they're not going to take the information in. So I tend to work on less speak, but more prominent points. So maybe go for three or four points in the game in how we're gonna play, because you need to, as I say, it's about calming that mind.
That season, obviously we were out of grandstand, and it was a bit ramshackle with changing rooms in the car park and whatnot. Did that work in our favour in any way, do you think?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, because if we were going to other grounds and it was like it was, you wouldn't inspire. You know, you're walking into a porter cabin, round the back end of a, as you say, around the back end of a car park. And, you know, the manager's office was, another bit of a poor cabin that we worked in. But I think that did work in our favour. I think that, you know, it made it a difficult place to come. Because when you go to some grounds, everything's nice and laid out. I think, without a shadow of doubt, I think it helped, definitely.
At what point that season did you think there was a chance that we could really have a go at the top? Because there are a few key results, you know, the Boxing Day win against Swindon, the New Year's Day on second against Plymouth. But obviously we were going on that run of an incredible winning one run with clean sheets. What point did you think there was a chance that we could really have a go and push for promotion?
Look, I mean, I think, as I said, when I first come in, you know, the remit mainly from the board was, you're coming in late, there's been a lot of upheaval, just wanting to settle it down in the first year. But that's never in my psyche, if I'm totally honest. You know, now, did I think that we could do what we did? Probably not at the time, but I would have been probably looking 12 upwards rather than 12 downwards, if I'm totally honest. That's how I would do things and have done things. But once we got going and once we got on a roll, it was a case of keeping it real. Really, is that this can be done? You know, we are the shock. And every now and then you do get one of them teams that's a shock that are up there, and we was that team for that year. I don't think there was any game or time that I felt that. You know, this is, we are going to do it, or we're going to get the top seven. For me, it just rolled into the improvements that we were showing, and I felt that then it was going to give us a chance. But I still built on the underdog mentality. You know, I remember keeping the odds, and I think we were 66-1. I think at the start of that season to go out to win it, I think that was, which was one of the bottom six prices, and I kept that and kept showing it people to say, you know, this is what people expected of us, and this is where we are. So I kept that underdog, just because you're doing well and you become more of a not an underdog, but you still remember from where you come from, and that was to build the players' confidence, if I'm totally honest.
One of the keys for me that season was consistency of selection. I think we probably only used about 20 players throughout the entire season. And since then, you know, in seasons gone by, we've been using closer to 40. How much luck is involved in that? Or is it just good management at good times to ensure you're getting the same players turning up week in, week out?
I think there's a lot of luck. You know, I ain't going to sit here and say that I'm a magician, because I think a lot of it, you've got to be lucky with the injuries, the suspensions. You know, we was lucky in that time. But because I knew I was quite shallow squad from the start, myself and Sean Taylor, who obviously was my assistant at the time, we talked about maybe not so much work on the training ground in terms of leg work, because we knew we was off a shallow squad. So again, I think that comes down to, I believe you can do what you got to do in maybe a 90-minute session. You know, some managers might see it differently, but I just felt that, and also it was quite important to give players rest and recovery. You know, because we knew that they was going to be going again, we tried to keep the training schedules was quite light. You know, and we still worked on the tactical stuff, but we might walk through a tactical instead of run through a tactical and that type of stuff, and have a belief in the players that they were looking themselves off the pitch, because fitness wise they was good. But again, I think some of that comes down to the belief in your strength as a manager, that you got to believe that, you know, I think some people get over, you do more time on the training pitch because the manager's head is scrambled. Then if you can keep it light and keep it as, you know, as light as you possibly can, I think you then got a chance of keeping players fitter for longer. But that's something I've always worked on, if I'm totally honest.
with some of the injuries and suspensions, obviously, I know we've sort of lost a couple of players for slightly longer term injuries. I think Ian Morris was out for a couple of months, and then Brian Saar got injured against Plymouth and he was out for a little while. How key was Damian Davey through that period?
Look, he was the best. You know, he was the best. He was, again, when I got there, to have someone like Damien in the treatment room, someone that had a football background anyway, but his knowledge was excellent. You know, we leant on Damien a lot in terms of rest and recovery as well, because, you know, most clubs you go to, it was sports scientists, et cetera, et cetera. So Damien done dual well, really. He was the physio. But he also would work with us in terms of what we should, times people should be on their feet. And because I had a belief in him, if you've got a belief in your physio, if he told me someone shouldn't be training, you know, he was coming from a good place. So he was, him and Kenny Vasey, who was the goalkeeping coach. So the unit of staff, well, you know, I was blessed there. Sometimes you go there and you think, I need to change him. But Damien and Kenny were brilliant for us. But Damien, you know, on the injury front, but also on the sports science side of things, was first class.
Did you find that you were able to save a bit of money in the budget by finding Rennie Howe every time he got sent off?
Yeah, look, Rennie was Rennie. And you're gonna have to take that the rough with the smooth. And there was always a fine system. You know, with Rennie, you live very much on the edge. You never quite knew what was going to happen on the football pitch. But yeah, it gave us a little bit of fine money for players.
Someone I did want to ask you about was Kevin Nicholson, who Paul Buckle was starting to try and edge out before you, and then was bombed out pretty quickly after you left. But he was ever present for you, and he was brilliant in your time there. Were you surprised that he became a manager so quickly? And just, we love Kevin Nicholson, and he's a bit of a figure of fun. He'll take everything at face value. So just give us an insight into Kevin Nicholson, the bloke and the player.
Look, when you look at Kev, let's be honest about it, he don't attract the eye in terms of looking like an athletic. You know, that's true. You know, people would always say what he couldn't do, you know, in terms of that he wasn't the quickest, he wasn't the, you know, but he had a wonderful left foot. He was a good, solid defender, and he could set off a lot of our attacks. So Kev was, for me, was, again, I think I put him in there with the Mansells and the, you know, Canes, the Rennie Owls, the Mark Ellis and Roberts. But again, he was one of them that talked football, if I'm honest with him. And Lee Mansell wanted to sit down after training, and you might be having a bit of lunch, and they would ask questions. So you always felt that they were the two that were likely to go into coaching and management, because that's something they wanted to do. And yeah, his knowledge was good. But I'd always say people like Kevin don't jump to the book by the cover. You know what I mean? And I think other managers ain't liked him as much as me. They talk about the things he can't do, but I just think he give us a lot as a player.
Was it under your management that he scored the sort of 94th minute winner against Barnet?
I think it was, yes. Yeah, it was, I think. Yeah, we played. It was Barnet away, wasn't it?
No, it was a home game.
Oh, no. Yeah, I think I was. Don't ask me to remember every game. but I think it was, actually.
And did he ever shut up about it for about 6 weeks after, or was he still going on about it?
Oh, yeah, well, Kev's Kev, and he would tell you about all these good bits, and yeah, he would tell us what he had done and how he'd done it. But, yeah, no, as I say, I got on really well with Kev. As a player, again, another one that I've talked to, but, yeah, I had a common bond, and he, I think he wanted to know everything, but he sometimes he was the butt of the jokes, not by me, but by the players.
One of the things that I found about Kev when he managed was earlier on you said about being honest in your interviews and, you know, being honest with the fans. And I think that's one thing that he definitely took from your management, is whenever he did anything post-match when he was managing us, it was always completely honest, completely from the heart. So that's certainly something that I think probably rubbed off well on him, because he spoke very candidly whenever he spoke to the press after a game.
Look, I think what you got to do as a football manager is prove that you're a human, because people don't think that you are. You know, they think that you should be, you know, doing this and doing that, but you're a human being at the end of the day. And if you speak from the heart and honestly, that's why I never go into, as I say, I've never gone into any interview knowing what I'm going to say. I don't entertain that, because I think that if you're doing an interview, you have an interview process. And if you're honest and open, I think you get a lot more respect in that way. Sometimes you can be go a little bit close to the edge, and people saying, "Oh, you know that you're too honest and open." But for me, I don't think you can be. I think you can, as long as you're not crossing any line. You know, when I say not going into an interview, of course I know what I shouldn't be saying, because you've got that in your mind. But at least you've got to be honest and open with your answers. And if you're that, you know, you can't. What I don't believe is if you take supporters. I've always said this, if you take supporters as people that don't know anything and they're idiots, then you're mad, because they are, you know, an awful lot of supporters are very knowledgeable about the game of football, so they're not going to be caught out and you know, someone going to pull the wool over their eyes by what people say, because you know, you hear it sometimes now, and I think, oh, it's the same old interview with the same old answers. But people know it, and I think if you're honest, especially if you're at a lower league club where there ain't so many supporters, and you're looking for them to be, you know, the 12th man, both home and away, then I think if you're honest and open, you've got a lot more chance of getting the people on the side.
Fast forwarding a bit, so we end of that season, we very narrowly miss out on automatic promotion. Going into the playoffs, was it hard to kind of almost sort of motivate the players again to start, you know, to start again in the playoffs, or was there still that belief in the camp that we can go up?
Look, I think that the team that just missed out, I've got the hardest job anytime you go into playoffs. It's something that I think is very up, because you're chasing and you think you're going to do it. And when you don't do it, you get that come down and you've got to lift yourself again. I think that team's always the one that I would say that I wouldn't put into my bet that they're going to make it. It would normally be a team that comes seventh or someone that ain't really been chasing all the time. And I think that's a really difficult, and you say the right things again, that we, you know, we can go again and we can be lifted and I think you can, but you have got the hardest job of the four teams that are in it, and I think that's what we had at that time. I remember being manager at all when we went up was 03-04, no, 06-05-06, and we went up by 15 seconds, and I always remember saying, if we never got up at that stage, there's no way we could have won the playoffs, because we had come that close. So, and I think it was the same for Torquay in that season.
Looking back on that season then, we had four players in the team of the year and we broke the club record for number of clean sheets. I mean, how do you look back on that season as a whole? I mean, for me as a fan, it was the best season I've ever had.
Look, great pride. I love my time at Torquay. That first year was something none of us expected, and you know, we was that close to pulling off the miracle, but we never quite did it. And as I say, I'd always go back there. We all know what happened the following year, but yeah, the first season was pride. I still look at my time there that it was cut short through no fault of my football ability or football managing ability. It was to do with my illness. And the first year was massive. And just because I went downhill in the second year, it doesn't mean I look at my time at Torquay with nothing but pride. I've been back. I love it. You know, I love going down there. As I say, I've got an affinity to the West Country because of my in-laws. But, yeah, nothing but pride. I'm glad that I think I've talked a couple of things with Torquay people, but they ain't been massive. But I'm really pleased when this comes through. So I just felt like it's something that I'm quite open and happy to talk about.
That's really nice, Martin, because it's something that obviously wasn't handled very well at all. And I don't think there's anybody associated with our football club who could ever say that they came out of it with any sort of credit, especially when the reason that was given at the end of the day was football-related, you know, results, when actually I think when you left, we were just outside the playoffs, and that season itself had been a relative success up until that point. And the form afterwards was the bit that sort of fell off a cliff somewhat. So did you feel that things were going as well as they could be in that first half of the season?
Yeah, look, I mean, it was handled, you know, I'm not going to sit on here and say that it was handled well. I think that that they made the wrong decision at the time. I can understand why they come up with the decision, you know, in terms of relieving me of my job. You know, I wish they would have just said they're relieving my jobs and don't want to work with someone that had mental health problems, because it couldn't be football. You know, if you come into a club when you're 18 months previously and you're told that you want to keep up, and then you keep them up and you was doing well until you went downhill, it was nothing to do with football. One of the things that is a bugbear of mine is that poor old Fia Bristow was tasked with picking the phone up to tell me. I could hear her shaking in her voice, and there wasn't people that were man enough to pick the phone up. It should never have been that woman who picked that phone up to me that day and told me that I'm finished because of football reasons. But, you know, when I was away, I was promised a lot about coming back and everything will be okay, you're going to have your job back. But from the inside, I was hearing different. But some people manoeuvred it into their favour, and you know, I regret that part of it. But I don't think it was going wrong football wise. I didn't see anything that was that now say my own mental health needed to be dealt with. And you know, I'm back working in football, and I've been back working in football for near enough 6 years now. Now there was another blip when I went to Swindon. So if I'd have come back, could there have been a second depression period? There could have been, but I don't think it was handled great. And I know why I was sacked. They can't say that, but you know, I know in my heart of hearts it was nothing to do with football.
Well, like you say, it can't have been, because I remember that going into that second season, it was when you lose Bobby Lesnick, Mark Ellis and Eunan O'Kane. You know, okay, goalkeepers and centre-backs are sort of replaceable. It's you can't, at this level, you can't replace a Eunan O'Kane like for like by any stretch. But considering the players we'd lost, and, you know, like you say, you've got Kevin Nicholson's your team. They're a year older. I mean, I don't think his performances have dropped an awful lot at all, but it's still, you know, a squad at that level was another year older. So I thought, all things considered, we were doing all right, because we were saying before we came on that it was the Exeter game was the first one that you weren't in the dugout for. And I think what really disappointed myself from the club was there was no communication, you know, somewhere, you know, for the fans, a manager that, like Nick said, even though under Buckle we had some really good success, at the time he wasn't someone that we were warm to. But I've never seen really a fan base at Torquay warm to a manager the way we warmed to you so quickly. And I think the fact that the club never came out and said anything and almost left us all guessing, it didn't sit right with us. And I'm not sure what your opinion was on that.
No, look, it's difficult because, you know, I went into the Priory and I was in the Priory in Rampton for 7 weeks. But I was quite open to talking about what had happened, and and come back, and because of saying that I've been into the Priory, you know, I had mental health problems, but it was, you know, Sean was given the job, Sean Taylor, that is, on an interim basis, and then they decided to change that. And the minute that I decided to change that, then it was always, I suppose, dodgy of what's going to happen. But I don't think that I don't know, somehow by the time of me not being there, I'd turn into a bad manager, you know, and it's to do with, I think they'd have been a lot better if they'd have and just been open and honest. Because if I always say this, and I do a lot of talks on depression in sport, and I talk about being a bank manager, where you can disappear for 7 weeks, you know, and be off ill, and come back because you ain't in the public domain. But the minute you're in the public domain, something's got to be said, because there was a lot of rumour and counter rumour that was going around, you know, people from, you know, brain cancer to this to that. And I think you would have just been, when looking back on it now, I wish I'd have just insisted that I come out. And when I come out of the Priory and I was starting to feel good, I wish I'd have just spoke up and said that, you know, I've had mental health issues. I'm doing my best to deal with them. I would like to come back to work at Torquay one day, and I think that would have made it more difficult for them if I'd have done that. I was worried about the depression and the mental health having a stain on the rest of my career. So by not saying anything, I think made it worse. It'd have been easier. I look at it now, and it's you know, when I just thinking about coming to late Norwich job, and I spoke openly with my American owners about, you know, I've had, you know, two bouts of depression and mental health issues, and you know, and they were like, well, we know that, we're prepared to go with that, and you know, and we're prepared, if you're happy to go along with doing the job and you feel that you can cope with the job, then we're happy with that. And I just wish I was open. But since the problem is with it is that the first time I had a taste of it was in 2010 when I was at Cambridge, and I disappeared for 12 days there. Again, it was brushed under the carpet. It was put down as a virus. And maybe at that stage, knowing that I was going, you know, straight back and the magnitude of it, it was the right thing to do. Second time, it's been the best thing in my life, is to come out openly and honestly about it. Because I have so much people come to me and talk about it, and I can give my I'm proud of it today, you know. And I would have been, but I wasn't at that stage, you know. In 2012, I didn't understand the illness, and I couldn't say that I was proud that I've had it and I've coped with it, and I still cope with it. I have to make sure I look after myself every single day. I know that now, and since I had the second bout, it just brought me home even more. But it's been so freeing to be open and honest on since the second time I've had it, that I wish I'd have been open and honest on the first occasion. The club knew about it, but if I'd have been open and honest and gone public with it from the start, I think it'd have been a lot easier for everybody. And I think that I would have definitely come back as Torquay's manager then. But the way I kept it in the dark as well as them made it a bit easier for them to get rid of me, I believe.
Do you feel that people and society in general are far more accepting now of mental health issues and, you know, things that you were suffering with? And you know, it's just a case of it, at the time it wasn't quite as widely talked about?
Yeah, like it's changed, you know. Men don't have emotions, you know. Even that was a lot of my problem. I mean, I come out of an East London background where, you know, if I'd have talked about emotions, you know, in the local pub where I was brought up, then I'd have been laughed out of the place. But the world's a different place. You know, people suffer. And I think the good thing about it is people that are in the public eye, I mean, I'm no way as big as some of the people that have come out about it, but it's just part of life. And I think it is a lot more open. It's, you know, I do a lot of talks, and people accept it today. I mean, I accept it today because it's, you know, it's the same as having something else that ain't quite right. My brain, as I call it, is not quite wired up right, and I have to make sure I look after myself and look after my brain. But I know the brain can make me get into dark places. But when it happened before, I would ignore it. And just my biggest problem, and the reason I had a breakdown, and then it was that I used to suppress everything. I used to be totally opposite to what I do now. So I used to hide everything and suppress everything and then push things down and don't deal with anything and don't deal with my emotions. And then it ends up in an explosion. So now I'm totally the other way. And it's so freeing. You know, it is so freeing. As I say, I think if Torquay would have been in 2020 instead of 2012, that might seem strange, but I think that it would have been an awful lot easier to cope with what I had to cope with, because I would have seen a lot more people talk openly and honest about it. And you see a lot of sports people talk openly and honest about it. So the world's a better place for that, in my opinion.
And do you feel, having sort of those experiences now, you're able to recognise the triggers before they become too big?
Yeah, look, I'll be honest with you, I promised my wife that I would never go into football management again. Now, I don't know if football management had a part to play with my mental health, but the last two times I did, I was a football league manager. So I don't want to test that again. I feel that ask that question again. Sorry, I've lost my track.
No, that's all right. I was just saying, in terms of having had the experiences you've had, the bouts that you've had over a couple, do you feel now that you're better equipped to deal with it and you can recognise those triggers sooner?
Yeah, obviously I know what makes me tick, what makes me work. The simple fact for me is that, you know, I can go to bed tonight and feel top of the world, and I can wake up in the morning and things don't seem so good. But what I have learned to do the first hour of every day is to readjust and do stuff that makes me level out. So before, I wake up in the morning and I feel like that, and then I'll just carry on and push it away. Now I embrace it. Every hour, first hour of every day is for me. You know, that's all I give myself every day, is that first hour, because I need to readjust. I need to, you know, and it just seems, because it's weird. As I say, I can go to bed and feeling okay, but somewhere during the night, you know, that feeling is not the same. But I know how to readjust now. I do certain stuff to help myself, and I don't let things build up. And I speak openly. I really do a lot of, I mean, and this is quite freeing, talking about it as we're talking about it now. I do a lot of talks that's freeing, because it's an acceptance of it. And as I say, all my problems come by suppressing it. So if you suppress what your feelings and what your head is feeling and what you're feeling, and you keep suppressing it, you're going to give it the chance to damage. I just deal with it. But also just knowing, I don't know if because my owners were American, that they, I remember when they offered me the job as director of football at A&R, and I said, "Have you read my bio? You know, in terms of put me in Wikipedia, the depression's on it." And they said, "Yeah." I said, "We know all about you." I said, "Okay, that's fine." And he said, "I think American probably was a little bit ahead of us in terms of counselling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." And I think it's something, as you say, that I know I could do this job. I think I could be a football manager again, but I promised my wife that I wouldn't. Now, is there a difference to doing the job I'm doing to what the job I do as a football manager? And I always say it's about, things don't live in my head anymore. When I was a football manager, you'd be winning a game on a Saturday, and you'd be thinking about what team you're picking on the Tuesday within an hour. With this job, I can be a lot more removed from it. Still want to win, but removed from it, and probably there's a lot less instant stress of what I do now. There's a lot more managing upwards, and I just feel it. But I also feel that, you know, 6 years after coming, or 7 years coming out of Swindon, that I'm a total different person. And as I say, the Torquay thing brought that on, but it's something. I'm not sure if they would have re-employed me, I don't know if I would have, because I didn't think I would. I don't know if I had enough knowledge of the illness then. I may needed that second period to give me all the knowledge. So yeah, but again, it doesn't take away from I felt I could still go and do the job at Torquay. I don't know if I would have done or wouldn't have done, but the be all end all is that I'm enjoying what I'm doing now. That's the main thing.
It's fantastic to know that, and we're all really pleased to know how well you're doing and how happy you are. One of the biggest problems with that horrible period is that we were kept in the dark, as we previously mentioned. And I think at that time, there was more focus on the football club than the individual. And hopefully that's a culture that is changing. But it was also a massive shame that we never got to say goodbye properly and say thank you. And you were sort of ushered out the back door without anyone knowing. That was terrible because you left a brilliant legacy for our football club. And I was so proud to support the club during that time. And I think since then, it's been all downhill. And all the problems we go through now as a football club are traced back to those horrible 6 months or so. And it just felt like you were a stable pair of hands. And we've been really struggling to find that stability ever since. And have you kept tabs on Torquay United's progress since you left? Or is it still something that you find a little bit of bitterness there, perhaps?
No, look, I'll keep tabs on it. You know, I'm just really disappointed in terms of what's happened, you know, since my time there. You know, you've been down to there as low as the Conference South, and obviously you could be heading that way again now if you ain't careful. I mean, my own boy, I don't know if you realise that Sam played there last week, so he plays for Dagenham, my boy, and so I know the National League. I do look at their results. Part of me is that I was really frustrated that I've never been able to say goodbye. And one day I may be able to, you know, there may be something to come down there and say the goodbye. You know what I mean? It's really open to the club. I've never been approached to do that. And I know that, you know, I see another, it's weird, isn't it? Because people that talk to you, you know, I could be on the underground or anywhere. And every now and then there'd be a Torquay supporter. And I know they're not going to come and say you was crap and I don't like you when I was there, but they've all got nice things to say. So I still, even though it was a black period of my life, I've got nothing but bright feelings for the club. I don't fully blame the club for the decision they made, because I think we was all a little bit in the dark. You know, when you look back, there's not an awful lot of managers that have suffered or this situation come up, but they handled it. When I look at it now, that they could have handled it better. But there's no animosity because I think it's different if they've had four cases and the other three cases they kept and they got rid of me. I think I was the first test case and they went down the wrong line. And I think it'd be nice if they admitted that one day, that the decision that they made was the wrong one. But it is what it is. And I say I don't hold anything against, especially Fia, you know, who broke the news. She was brilliant. And I blame people behind Fia that she was pushed into the frame to do that, if I'm honest. I thought people that could have been a little bit stronger and could have been picked the phone up. But, you know, I love my time there. In football terms, I love my time there. And it hurts me to see them. I don't look at it and think, well, they got rid of me when I was ill. I want them to suffer. I don't see it like that. And that's to do with me as well. I might have seen it, you know, pre my second illness, I might have been that type, but I just don't hold resentments or there's no point. What's the point? It ain't gonna be sitting in anyone else's head but my head. So it don't bother me. As I say, it could have been handled better. And I suppose the proof in the pudding for me is that if people look at what I'm doing here now, took over the club that was, you know, on its knees, coming as director of football, and looks like we could be getting back to League One. And so I just look at it and think, well, maybe people look at it now and think we made the wrong choice because Martin could have done a better job for us.
I think we speak for all Torquay fans, really, when that was one of the best seasons in modern history for Torquay, even though we didn't quite get over the line. I think after the disappointment the summer before, it was some of the best football I've seen Torquay play. It was the whole squad was, you just got the impression, I've never seen a squad play for a manager that way. And the bond that you had with the players and the fans. And like you say, it is such a shame that, and Ben said that it's such a shame we never got a chance to say goodbye and to say thank you for all of the, you know, for such a great year. And then the season after, it felt like the fans and yourself were kind of robbed of what could have been. But, you know, from that season, as you know, I'm a similar age to your son, actually. And at that age, it didn't get any better, you know, seeing your players, which your heroes, playing well, and a manager that loved the club and loved the team.
Yeah, look, my kids loved, you know, they used to watch us in London, come down there. Sam used to train. He came down as a 14-year-old and he used to train with the youth team, you know, and loved it. And he still talks about that today. He was a Leyton Orient sign player, but because he was down there for the week, he's come into training with me during the, you know, whether it was an Easter, this sort of time, actually, the Easter period, and he come down and then he trained with Jeff and Robbie and the boys. And he talks about, because obviously when you're 14 at that, it's a big learning curve and you're going into a professional environment and training with the youth team, where was that all? And he was still a schoolboy. As I say, you can honestly say to you, I don't have no grudges. I hold the club in high regard. It's someone, a club that I still, you know, hold close to my heart, because that year was a fabulous year. You know, what happened, and well, none of us can change that. But what we can do, we can appreciate what we had. And when I see someone approach me from Torquay to do this, I was like, yeah, I've not really. Not really talked to many people about that period, you know, and never really recounted closely what happened. So that's why you got to reply very quick from me to say, yeah, I'd love to do it, because I feel that it's, you know, that it's something we should be. It's 12 years ago, well, no, 10 years ago now, isn't it? So I'm coming at 11. So you got to, yeah, it's something that goes down in history, and you got an happy me now. I'm just hoping that you can get out of that bottom four. You need a couple few results going now to the end of the season.
Big Easter weekend coming up. I think it's really nice as well that obviously you are able to talk to us about it and explain the full situation of what happened. But I think it's really important for us to be able to remember how good those times were that you were with us as well, because it all kind of gets a little bit lost in the story of what happened and the departure, and not enough really is sort of celebrated about what you actually brought to the football club.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, I can see that, and I thank you for saying that. As I say, because when I look at it in football terms, it was nothing but good times, really. I mean, the second year wasn't as good as the first year, but it was a place that I enjoyed working, a place that where if you look over an 18-month period where results were really good, actually, you know. So it's, yeah, it's something. And they say that you get the black stain, or the black coffee stain, as I call it, at the end. But that's, you know, that as I say, that's something that's happened. But that shouldn't take away from 18 months of good times just because I went downhill.
And I think I can safely say we'll all be rooting for Orient to get over the line this season, because it'd be great to see you help another club get another promotion.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
No, well, I mean, look, Martin, thank you so much for coming on. It's been so good to speak to you, and hopefully we can sort something out that, you know, you come down to Torquay or play more, or even sort out some kind of Martin Ling event, because I'm sure there are other fans who want their chance to say goodbye.
If you get the club on board, I promise you that I will come down.
No, that'd be brilliant. Well, look, thanks again. And all the best for the rest of the season. Certainly be rooting for Orient.
Yeah, thank you so much, Martin.
Thanks, Martin.
Cheers. Good luck, lads.
Cheers.
Nice talking. All the best. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye.